Just what do you think you're doing, Dave? Dave, I really think I'm entitled to an answer to that question. I know everything hasn't been quite right with me, but I can assure you now, very confidently, that it's going to be all right again.
And now,
from the didgeridoo to 140 miles east of Kalamazoo, at least as far as Google Maps says, this version is a tribute to Motown.
Your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
This is your friend in podcasting, Phil Lairness, and over in the Motor City, that's Dean Haglund. How are you, Dean?
Hey, I'm doing great. How are you? How are you with that air quality being at 138? Wholly unhelpful.
Wow, I was going to say that it's like 7:05 in the morning, which is equally, if not more unhealthful. As long as I can see what I'm breathing psychologically, I'm fine. So it all plays into my hands perfectly. But no, we were in the heart of fire country and the worst of the air quality this week and many things to tell you about. Real quick, though, a disclaimer for those of you who enjoyed last week's otherwise awesome show. Yes, it was a little hard to hear at the beginning. A surprising electric hum of some kind was showing up only after the episode was recorded, not while monitoring it. So
that's weird. Maybe it was fuzz purring. Fuzz was purring.
Oh, well, I like that sound. That's true. It is the purring of a cat is like an electric hum. And you know what else it is? It's the ohm sound. It's the chanting ohm sound. It's the ohm of the universe is the sound of a cat purr. Anyway, apologies. As I said to Dean beforehand, we've only done 600 shows. We can't expect to have it down pat already. We're still early in our run, and we will we'll do better as we become more veteran at this podcast.
Yes, right? You know, it's the 10,000 hour rule. You got to do 10,000 hours to be an expert at something.
Oh my God. That explains my prison sentencing.
Yes. Sorry. I didn't know you had prison sentence.
I thought for petty crime, that was really extreme, but now I realize it was for my own well good.
Totally.
Yeah. My woodworking needed a little more expertise. Our movie, The Lady Killers, had a screening in San Leandro. And for those joining the party late, The Lady Killers is a dark, disturbing comedy. It's been described as exactly the kind of film we need right now. And San Leandro, California, is East Bay. It's near Oakland, California, just across the bay from San Francisco. And you can read these things and they can be staggering to you. Like San Francisco on Friday had the second worst air quality of anywhere on the planet.
Good Lord.
And San Francisco is a city that, for the most part, tends to have the what seems to be much cleaner air than most cities.
Right. They got an ocean breeze coming in that blows a lot of that stuff inland.
Surrounded by ocean because it's out there on that peninsula out in the bay. And it's the gateway to the Pacific. And also as a result, it's why San Francisco, even when the rest of the Bay Area is experiencing heat wave, often San Francisco's cold because it has its own climate entirely, right? And you see this when you go across the bay and go into Sausalito. It's amazing to look back across the bridge and whatever the weather you're experiencing in Sausalito, not the weather that's just across the Golden Gate Bridge.
Right. Often you get those pictures of fog-encased San Francisco that you can take from Sausalito side.
So truly extraordinary, right, for San Francisco to have such unhealthful air quality. I think, I forget which city, I'm going to bet that it was Beijing that had the worst air quality anywhere in the world, but certainly somewhere in China, right, where they have no environmental laws at all.
India has a very severe...
They do. But let's face it, China has quite a head start on them.
I guess.
Yeah. I mean, that wall was built so long before Christ was born. anyway.
What?
I don't know. But they probably didn't use the fossil fuel burning technology to build the wall. So that's where the whole thing falls apart. But I don't know. And all I say is just build the damn wall, as you know. Okay.
That's right.
But it was, so you read those things and you go, okay, well, that's really bad. But I live in Los Angeles, right? I know bad air quality. And of course
you do.
We'd had terrible smoke here in LA from the Malibu fires, right? A walk to go interview our friend Alana Rain about her narrative feature film debut, an interview that we'll share in the coming weeks on this show. It's a walk that I do probably once a week. To one of my favorite places in LA, and it took me twice as long, literally twice as long as ordinary, to do that walk, and I was walking at full speed. Such is the weight, or was, at least that day last week, on my lungs while doing this uphill walk. Yeah, I mean, I really felt like by the time I arrived, I had the flu. You know, in terms of the eyes watering and the sinuses and the lungs burn, it was real being achy. It was just from what I was inhaling. Okay, so it was bad in LA, and that was nothing compared to what it was like up in Northern California. And the first signal of this was when Lily and I drove over the Grapevine in the morning to head up I-5, and you know, the I-5 area there, that Central Valley, especially down south of Bakersfield, is often, again, really bad air quality because all the industrial smog tends to come down south towards Los Angeles and then gets trapped by the two mountain ranges, right?
Right.
The mountain range that stretches to the east of, let's say, the 99 freeway, and the mountain range that stretches to the west of the 5, thus creating the Central Valley of California.
Right.
And no sooner had we been 5 minutes past the Grapevine down in the Central Valley than I lost sight of both those mountain ranges.
What?
Yeah, you couldn't see them. Such was, in the middle of the day, the fog. You know how usually when you're driving, the worst visibility is at dusk, right? It's not at night because you can get your eyes adjust. It's at dusk because the glare of that completely diffused light makes depth perception so difficult.
Yeah.
Imagine driving in that at the middle of the day. And so that when it was dusk, your visibility actually improved.
Good Lord.
So that was bad, and that was nothing compared to the Bay Area. as we approached San Leandro from the east, taking the 580 freeway from the 5 into the Bay Area, a road that I've taken many times, especially when I've driven my sister to her medical appointments at the Stanford Medical Center. If I had not known that I was on the 580, I would not have believed it. Because
really?
I was deprived all visible landmarks. It was, Lily asked me at one point, wow, is this just really thick fog? And so that I could deny the actual truth of it, I said, yeah, this is fog. That's what that is.
Right.
And there was probably some fog.
Right, that temperature difference.
Mixed in with thick smoke.
Right.
And so it was terrible. It was just terrible. And schools canceled. Universities canceled. Work, even jobs canceled to just tell people stay indoors.
It's so deadly.
So my heart obviously goes out to all these people. Because even if you're not prone to allergies or asthma, I mean, this is not healthful. And of course, for our pets, not healthful. For the animals that are outdoors, not healthful. And
right.
And of course, I want to even joke and say worst of all, but it's not even funny to do that. But I will say that our attendance at our screening was affected. And how do I know this? Because we had something like, 140 tickets sold to this thing, free screening. So 140 tickets,
right,
RSVP'd, let's say, and maybe 25% of those people showed up. And and part of it was, just the air quality being really unhealthful. We heard that from even relatives who couldn't make
right.
it because of that. And other, because the traffic, due to the visibility, right? Car crashes and the danger of driving in that. Our friend Yoshi was coming from the South Bay, maybe a 45-minute to a one-hour drive away, and it took him 2.5 hours to do that.
Wow.
Drive.
You're kidding.
So it was tough. But we thank those who were brave enough to come out, both because of the air quality and the traffic, but also because our movie is really, really disturbing. And
right.
And it was funny because you watched the movie. One of the criticisms that has been leveled against the movie, and I want to talk to you about this, not just in terms of our movie, but in terms of movies in general and how we tell stories and the danger of the technological availability of seeing the film in so many different formats in so many different places.
Right.
And especially when, as we know, tone is everything in a movie. One of the criticisms that was leveled against the film from the very beginning, by those who were rooting for the film, not people who were looking for a reason to criticize it, right, was
right.
that it starts too slowly. And that pacing has improved and evolved, of course. But it's
right.
still something I hear from time to time, that the movie starts too slow, and it takes a while before it gains steam. And I would say, yes, you're absolutely right, but it assumes that slow is a pejorative, that it is
right.
a problem, that taking one's time to set something up is unwanted, that you automatically are supposed to hit the ground running.
Right.
If you think, as many of these people do, that the pacing is so pleasing, in the case of this movie, it's pretty much once the rules start being delivered.
Right.
So towards the end of Act
yeah.
One. But if you're someone who thinks the pacing is pleasing from that point on, is it really a problem that the film doesn't achieve that pacing earlier? Or is it that slower pace that allows you to enjoy what comes so much?
Right. That's a great question. Is it our attention span gone to hell, or
is it,
and
is it how you're watching the film?
You're watching the film. Yes. If you're watching it at home and distracted, as you said, putting on pause, going over there, so on and so forth. Then is that affected? It's funny because,
And also, how about screen size? How about screen size also for a movie like this? Because if you're watching it on a bigger screen, you are aware probably earlier on, oh my God, there have been some intentional placements of clues already, and I don't even know what the mystery is. So are you paying closer attention and examining and looking for those things, which then changes how the pace feels to you? If you're more active, the pace feels differently. I'm not saying it necessarily feels faster, but you're engaging with it in a different way.
Yes, correct.
But so the answer that was given, and of course we took that feedback, and things were done to not only change the pace, but change one's relationship with it. Score the movie differently, introducing some musical themes so that audiences hopefully would be able to grab a handle on it and go, okay, I get a sense of where this is going, and just emotionally hold your hand and let you know, don't worry, stick with this. So there's different things. The introduction of players a little differently with some cards, some textual treatments. You know, again, to give you things to look for to make you more active. But I will say that in terms of how it's laid out, the structure is still the structure. And the opening involves the introduction of the players themselves. And the note that came often while we were putting the film together, and that we get far less often, but it usually accompanies the note that the opening is slow, is why didn't you just start with the reading of the rules?
Right.
And you're laughing. Why are you laughing at that?
Well, because that's kind of not the whole point. I mean, I don't know. To me, it's the characters, right? You're developing, you're laying out who's involved before what's involved.
Yeah, and I would say we understand that, but if you are an audience member, there aren't those kind of rules. Let's call them rules, right?
Sure.
And a lot of movies would start with the rules. And that massive sound you would hear would be people turning off the movie. Yes, as there's one review on Amazon right now from a listener or from a viewer who said, oh man, this sucked. I turned it off a quarter of the way through. Well, that's a great review. So all you've reviewed is your inability to watch a whole movie. You know, seriously, because how do you know? You don't. I mean, it's not me being defensive. It really is true. This is basically a 100-minute movie. If you turned it off, it's actually a little bit longer than that. So if you turned it off a quarter of the way through, let's take this viewer at their word. You didn't even get to the rules. So you literally have no idea what the movie was even about. You know, this is why, by the way, like at the Academy Awards, when it's for documentary or for foreign language film. Now, I can't speak to what the rules are now, but I do know that for many years, and I'm willing to bet that it's still something close to this for foreign language film, to be able to vote for these on the committee, on the foreign language branch, you have to sign in to a certain percentage of the screenings of the submitted films, and you have to watch all of the movie. If you don't achieve that, you're not eligible to vote because you didn't do your work. You didn't actually see the movies, right? Because they understand that it's not fair to give the movie. It didn't grab me in the first 20 minutes. Well, were you reading subtitles? That could have had something to do with it. Right. You got to get into the process of it. But I will also, but getting back to my point, though, I really firmly believe that if you start with these rules, no one's sticking with this movie. Because, yeah, the pacing will be better, but everything about this movie and these people are so hateful then. From the opening moment, why would you watch?
Right. There'd be no reason to. And you would, I agree.
And so it was great being at the theater the other night because there was like this group of people who arrived late and they literally walked in right before the rules were delivered. What group do you think came out to complain about how bad the movie was a short while later?
Oh, the ones that hated everybody.
Those people who had arrived just in time for the rules. Yeah.
So you are right.
Well, I mean, it just, I mean, it doesn't mean that we won't lose people because it's slow. I mean, it's slow attention span. But I do say this when people criticize, you know, how slow something is. You know, again, are you criticizing something for what it's not? Or are you criticizing it for what it is? And it's easy to say, oh, it's slow. But that is so in the point of view of the observer. It's more of a reflection on you than on the piece itself.
And on the times.
And on the times. Absolutely. Yeah.
And this is, again, in context. And I'm going to tie this into Orson Welles' film on Netflix, The Other Side of the Wind.
Oh, great, great, great. Great.
Because I think
this is going to tie back into our film, believe it or not, because I thought about that movie while watching our movie this time for the first time.
Yeah,
because I had a really uneasy feeling watching The Lady Killers that was new to me, different than all the other uneasy feelings that the movie generates. But so this is a movie, Other Side of the Wind, shot in 71, finished the first time in the late 70s, but then destroyed and re-put together in the last couple years. And,
right.
And what struck you about the pacing of that?
Well, I was struck by what, again, I thought was, oh, look how slow, but not just slow, repetitive. A lot of the chatter, a lot of the, you know, jump cuts from different film stock, black and white to color, all of that would seem to be in my mind going, oh, I guess as they reassembled this, they were just going off the template of what they had and just kind of repeating it. But then as I got into it and you get into 45, an hour or so,
yes.
Then you realize, oh my gosh, no, it's a hypnotic effect.
Yes.
It is, you know, this whole idea of it's not slow, it's not a mistake. It's a treadmill that's taking you in for this journey that you are totally then absorbed into, and it has a completely different effect as on the viewer that I was so amazed at, which I think was intentional. It has to be intentional, of course, and was a trait of Orson Welles. Well, that he often, when he directed, had that ability to do.
Well, he was commenting so much on. He was kind of mocking in no small way, and it's easy to forget this because we don't live in that era anymore again, but he was mocking the director-centric approach to movie making and movie appreciation of the 60s, especially in Europe, which was starting to come to America, right?
Right. The auteur.
Right. We were going to get ours. We were going to get Coppola's and Scorsese, and he was making fun of this, but not just the culture around it. Also kind of what he found to be the numbing imprint of personality onto material. Not style.
Right.
Because
he
was a very stylish director and would explore different styles. But it wasn't because it was this is my personality, right? This is my signature. And so he was mocking these things in some ways because I think what he's also saying is, you know, well, this is what I think is interesting. You describe basically how slow it feels, how labored it feels, and yet you just explained it's actually, it could not be cut more quickly. It's fast cutting, it's cross cutting, we're switching from here and there, we're getting only little pieces of conversations, and it feels slow.
Yeah, so this amazing.
So this idea of speed doesn't necessarily make something feel faster. It's about how engaged you are and what kind of spell it's casting and the tone of it. These things have an important role to play because then you're right. This was the stunning magic trick, and Orson Welles was a magician. I don't mean that metaphorically. I mean literally. He was a magician, and he brought that sense to making movies. But there are these conversations then in the second hour that are so slow and so quiet, and they're riveting.
They're riveting, and it's at the end of the party or in the middle of the party, right?
Like when the actor's teacher shows up.
Yes, Oh yeah.
And and they reveal what the actor was really like. And he wasn't, there's the great line, he wasn't committing suicide, he was auditioning. It's such a good line. But
that's such a good line.
Anyway, so you're right. So now here's my complaint, and I know it's not true, but I'm sitting into this big theater, this Art Deco masterpiece, the Ball Theater, which has you'd be really pleased to know they continue to lovingly restore. And so it's just getting more and more beautiful. And so this big screen, this big wall of sound, and I'm sunk down and immersing myself into it. And I feel like our third act is way too fast. It's way too fast in terms of the pacing of it. Isn't that interesting?
Really?
Isn't that interesting?
That is interesting.
It's unnerving to me how fast it is. Now, I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm just saying that, you know, there's a difference now between me being inside the movie and making it and feeling, okay, this is how the movie wants to express itself, versus now I'm back as a viewer with my preferences.
Aha.
Because we don't always make movies, not only the movies that we would want to see, nor the movies the way we would want to see them. We try to honor, you know, you try to ride the horse in the direction it wants to go.
Right. Yes, it is its own thing. So you're saying then now as a viewer, your preference is that you wanted the pacing to slow down in the third act?
Yeah, I like a mystery that resolves, with a different pacing. Again, I mean, it's just in terms of my enjoyment factor. Isn't that odd?
That's fascinating.
And of course, and of course, I'm someone who knows what's going to happen.
Yeah. Do you think that's a difference?
Well, but I would argue that probably that generally makes things seem slower, doesn't it? If you know what's going to happen.
That is true.
Although
I can't watch Murder on the Orient Express anymore.
Well, yeah, exactly. It makes things feel slower. On the other hand, maybe it also, if you know what's going to happen in the case of our film, maybe it does make the discomfort feel like it's lasting too long since I know what's going to happen, or go too fast, or it makes it feel like it goes too fast. Whereas it expands outward if you don't know what's going to happen because there's so much tension. I don't know.
Right.
I don't know. But I do know, as we talked about last week, I gave the third act its own style altogether. And it is not a style that I generally bring to bear on work. It's not that I was being a tourist. I mean, I really had planned it out in advance, but it was, and it felt right, but it wasn't something that I often lend myself towards, right? I mean,
right.
It's more in me to approach the dark comedy the way we do in that first act and that second act, which is more of a Kubrick kind of approach to it. Or a Sergio Leone approach. And I remember saying to you way back when, is it odd that I find myself hearing the good, the bad, and the ugly theme when I'm shooting these? And you're the one that pointed out, no, he edited those movies to maximum comedic effect. You know, it was clear that to Leone, when you watch it, this stuff's funny. Even if the effect, and there's occasionally jokes that are really perfectly edited, but even if it was the effect to the audience is, oh my God, this is unbearably tense or unbearably exciting or what have you, it's true. Kubrick and Leone, they found their stuff funny.
Right. And you mock something by doing a perfect impersonation of it, right? It's like Team America. That's actually a dead-on action film. I mean, beat for beat, act for act, that has all the same pacing. If it's not marionette puppets, if that was real people, that would come across as probably a fair to Midland action movie.
Yeah, maybe even better than that, honestly.
Better than that. But the point being that they're mocking it so well that it can play if, you know, if you don't have puppets in it, that could play as a real movie.
Yeah.
Not that it isn't a real movie, although, but you know what I mean.
I mean, the puppets do give a more nuanced performance than the actors in most Michael Bay movies. So that's the thing.
All right. What you did?
So we, at the risk of, you know, remember that I'm still pained by the one reviewer of this podcast. We have nothing but 5-star reviews on iTunes, but one bad review years ago that referred to our show as nothing but an infomercial. So at the risk of
what were we selling back then?
Truth is out there because we were so immersed in the making of it that it seemed like we were doing nothing but selling a movie that people wouldn't even be able to see for a while. And then the other thing was the chill pack. And this guy said, guys, it's fine to push one of them, but both is overkill. And well, thank you, sir. Well, you'll be pleased to know the chill pack is no more. And anyway, but I do want to talk about this theater because you've been there before, and I didn't realize what a history the Bowel Theater in San Leandro has, and how much it ties into a couple of things we've talked about in stories we've shared in recent weeks. And I'll share one of those. But the Bowel Theater was billed as the Bay Area's most modern theater in the press when it opened in 1946. And it was dazzling and lavish. And it was a time when I think San Leandro had 5 theaters. And it was a replica, even outside of it, which doesn't exist anymore. It had a replica of the forecourt of the Grauman's Chinese Theater, for crying out loud. No.
That's cool.
With hands and footprints. Opening night of the Bowel Theater was hosted by radio personality Dean Maddox as master of ceremonies. Dick Juergens and his big band performed, and movie star Virginia Weidler christened the theater's box office with a bottle of champagne as airplanes dropped streamers and confetti on the crowd below. This was a big deal.
That's a big deal.
Opening night double feature was The Bandit of Sherwood Forest and Getting Gertie's Garter. how great is that?
Wow. Where can I see Getting Gertie's Garter?
You haven't seen it? I've actually seen that. So there you go.
You have not.
Yes, I have. I think I saw that in film school, for crying out loud. So construction of the theater was completed in 6 months at about a cost of $250,000. So that's some substantial money in 1946.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, World War II had ended less than a year before. So that's a lot of money. That really surprises
me. Big deal.
And that they could get it made so quickly. You know, I always think that, like, construction materials might have still been in short supply after the war. But it has continuously operated, though, under different owners, obviously, but for 70 years. That is no small feat.
That is no small feat. And not having it close and not having it be torn down.
The architect was Vincent G. Rainey, who specialized in commercial projects, designed many roadside works, including over 600 service stations and more than 40 movie theaters, including traditional urban neighborhood theaters, drive-ins, shopping center theaters, and most were built between the 1940s and 70s. And his crown jewels were all Art Deco masterpieces, like the Bowel Theater, the Kuhio Theater in Honolulu, which was also 46, and the El Rey Theater in Vallejo, 1949. He died in 2002, but he also designed some of the Sayufi theaters of my youth, the domes that were so lovely there in San Jose. But the owner and the operators were Rene T. Lamar and George Drummond, and they opened the theater in 46, as I mentioned, out of their love and passion for live entertainment, as well as for the growing movie business. So here it is, 46, and it's kind of a throwback because, as you remember, it's got this big stage, which makes you think when you walk in to this Art Deco theater with this big stage, wow, this must have been built in the 20s, right?
Right, vaudeville era.
Yeah, but instead, Lamar, who was a vaudevillian theater proprietor back in the day, he was also with Drummond, the co-owner of Trilon Records. And at the time, that was one of the West Coast's largest record producers of jazz, big band, blues, and other what was considered urban music at the time. So wow. Their idea was to use the theater like the ball to bring their recording artists on tour in theaters that they owned.
That's cool.
Yeah, so that's why they saw the benefit of keeping stages in the mix rather than
interesting
movies only. And that's the reason, ironically, that it's been continuously operating for 70 years, because even now, what allows them to keep that open and keep renovating it are the music shows.
Isn't that clever?
So a story about this that I love. We talked about Marty Balin from Starship, who died, right? The founder of Starship, who died recently in the last few weeks. I think it was certainly the last couple months. And I forget what his real name was, but Balin was not his real name. And Drummond and Lamar represented him. They saw him. They saw talent in him. And so they took him to Los Angeles, where he signed a deal back in the 60s with Gene Autry's record label. Gene Autry owned a record label, right? The Singing Cowboy was a brilliant businessman. He wasn't just a cowboy star, right? He really was one of those guys like Glenn Ford that invested in entertainment properties. So he had a successful record label. Of course, he was the longtime owner of the California Angels, for crying out loud, baseball team.
And the Gene Autry Museum. I think he owns that.
Did he own it? It wasn't just named in his honor. Okay.
I think he actually was the proprietor. Driving force behind it. But I think he was owning
the museum of Western
Heritage.
That
holds his stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, great theater there, by the way, that puts on, you know, home of the Native American Theater Company here in Los Angeles.
Right.
So he signs the deal, but they're standing outside with Balin in front of the Chinese Theater. And, you know, one of these owners, I think it's Lamar, says to, but might have been Drummond, one of the others says to Marty, you know, you're really, really talented. But now that we manage you, we're going to change your name because your last name just doesn't work, right? And he goes, okay, what are you going to name me? And we're going to name you after our flagship theater, the Bal Theater.
No
We're
going to
call you Marty Balin. Yeah. And that's how Marty Balin got his name, was for the Bal Theater in San Leandro.
That's a great story.
So anyway, big thanks to Dan Dillman. And by the way, Dan Dillman, who you know, of course.
Of course.
At X-Fest, they hosted a test screening before we were even done of The Truth Is Out There. A screening that, as you know, I feared to no end because I'd been working laboriously on that movie, didn't even know what we had. And I was certain that I was lining up for a firing squad. Especially with that audience that's so into that material. And, you know, and I was waiting to hear everything like, oh, we already knew all this stuff, or, oh, you got all this wrong, or, oh, you know, whatever. Oh, you didn't include this, or, oh, you spent too much. You know, I just really expected just nothing but negativity. And and as they lined up for the microphones, and you were standing with me on stage, right? And the very first guy that got up to the microphone says, I want you to know. And I go, oh, here we go. Shit, I want you to know is always bad.
That's bad.
And the guy said, this is a major achievement. And I melted, and you had to hold me up because, like, I almost fell at that moment. All the exhaustion hit me of those. And the movie wasn't done. We did make some changes coming out of that screening, but we knew we really had something, or at least I knew we really had something at that point, and I didn't know that prior to that. But Dan Dillman and his family, this guy is such a light. I mean, he is, and as the years go by, he just becomes more and more of a bright light, Dan Dillman. And I don't mean just metaphorically and just right. in terms of describing his spirit. I mean, you know, you say like there are certain people that when they enter a room, they just light up the room.
Right.
It's because some people just have light emanating from them. And Dan Dillman, the proprietor of this theater, is one of these people. And so
now, are you saying this because he cut you a deal on the screening or what?
No, I just mean it. I mean, I think it's not a coincidence that this theater just has more and more of a beautiful shine to it. And it's not just because of all the hard work they're putting into it to restore it and maintain it and revitalize it. But also it's his personality. This guy is every bit the institution, the local treasure that the theater itself is. And they're really right. lucky. They're really, really lucky because, living in L.A., how many great theaters are there where we say, man, you know, why isn't someone doing something more with this? Why aren't they doing something different with this?
Right.
Like, this space is beautiful. Why are we not excited about it? And it's because right. the human component is lacking.
Isn't that amazing? That's still a thing. That's yeah. still a thing in this day and age.
He's a bit of an impresario, and at the same time, just about the nicest, most
nicest
humane guy you could imagine. Yeah,
totally. Yeah.
Which explains why now two times running he hasn't been elected mayor of San Leandro. I mean, I both want somebody like him in politics, and I want someone like him staying the hell away from politics, because I worry that the toxicity will damage the fragile, beautiful vision of his human heart. So, all right.
Yeah, that's true. Okay.
Okay. Hey, should we open up the Chill Pack morgue?
Let's do it.
Celebrity deaths.
Yeah, hey, I haven't been keeping up.
Yeah, the bodies are piled up here, Dean Haglund. And we need to do a curriculum vitae autopsy on all these people. All right.
Fantastic. The CVA, as we call it.
I guess we'll get started with our favorite, country music.
Of course. I'm up on my country music stars.
Roy Clark. You will know who Roy Clark is.
Of course.
I was
a Hee-Haw fan.
Were you really?
Well, yeah, huge Hee-Haw. I watched it all the time.
I want to hear about this. Now, was
you didn't watch Hee-Haw?
Was country music? Well, I knew Hee-Haw, of course, and watched it a little bit, but was country music, I've never asked you this, was country music popular in the parts of Canada where you grew up? Because it... It was. Okay.
Yeah. 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 No, I grew up in the country where country musicians would often come and perform.
Well, I always forget that, even having been in parts of Canada that I think are similar to parts where you grew up, because I always think, okay, it's north of the border. It's a different country. That's a different culture. But then again, I'm now remembering, boy, we kind of drove through the Old West.
Yeah. Yeah. Alberta. Holy smokes. That is as country as that can get out there. And in fact, Hee-Haw was produced by two Canadians originally. And they hired Roy Clark. And what they did is they were the first show to be syndicated only. So they never had a network sponsor that show. They cut it together and then went down to the NAB thing every year and just sold it straight from the table. Just go, we got a show you can strip in. It's got country music stars. It's got comedy. And it was easy to produce. You could just have cutaways. You could film segments at any time. Anything that was offensive, they didn't mind you cutting out. If you didn't like a joke or a performer, and you cut something else in. And there were 30-minute shows that they sold into syndication from day one and made millions of dollars.
Can you imagine... Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah. And Roy Clark was the lead. He was the center of the whole thing.
He and Buck Owens co-hosted from 69 until 86. And then Roy Clark continued to host it all the way till 97 himself. So that's almost a 30-year run. And I was just thinking, can you imagine? Because the world was really different in 97, especially politically, right? Can you imagine the power that someone like Roy Clark would have if he was, you know, hosting that towards the tail end of his hosting run today. A la, you know, someone like Johnny Carson. I mean, these are figures that were so beloved no matter where you were, culturally
right.
or politically, right? Because I did not grow up enjoying country music. It took until well into my adulthood before I learned to really start appreciating some country artists. And, you know, just as things are, you don't get exposed to it or whatever. And my
right.
only exposure to it was shows like Hee Haw. And so to me, Roy Clark, and this is not to to diminish his musical abilities at all, but rather to compliment him as a host and a performer. To me, he was a performer who played music, not a musician who could host.
Oh, interesting.
And
yeah,
because he was really comedically gifted, and just again this kind of personality that everybody liked and gravitated towards. And as a result, he really did grow the popularity of country music. I gather he was a renowned guitarist and banjo player long before that show began. But again, I knew him outside of Hee Haw, not for his music, but for the recurring role he had as a businessman on the Beverly Hillbillies.
No, that's right. I forgot about that, actually. But
you know,
right.
And so he just had this really warm, inviting persona that can't be faked.
Right. Yeah. And that's the thing. He enjoyed the Hee Haw so much that you enjoyed, even if it was corny jokes, even if you didn't like a performer or two, he would always, they have that one cutaway that we always make fun of now. It's like, ha ha. And now here's Buck Owens.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
It was such
that's
a transition.
Funny.
That anyone else would never be able to do. But
by the way, speaking of corny jokes and television, I heard this on the radio the other day, and it's an old Ernie Kovacs joke. And
okay.
You probably know it, but it tickled me no end. But it was Ernie Kovacs said, and this is, of course, he's a TV star in the 50s, but really sardonic in a way that was ahead of the times. I mean, Ernie
Absolutely.
Kovacs is quite a modern sort of figure. Prefigures a lot of modern comedy. But his joke was, do you know why they call television a medium?
Why?
Because when it's well done is so rare.
Hey.
Yeah, so that
there
was
you
fun.
Go.
There you go.
That's pretty good.
All right. Anyway, Roy Clark also, let's not give short shrift, though, to his music. He has been cited as an influence musically for many country stars, including Brad Paisley, who is one of the modern country acts that I really, really admire. And his biggest crossover hit was with 1969's Yesterday When I Was Young. And that is, boy, that's a powerful song. It reached number 19, and it was his only top 40 hit. He started playing guitar, banjo, and mandolin as a teenager, won the World Banjo Guitar Championship. He was 17 when he made his first performance at the Grand Ole Opry. That's a big deal, right?
That's a big deal.
And he was a member of the Grand Ole Opry and was inducted into the Country Music Hall of Fame.
Wow.
Roy Clark.
There 80, you go.
85. Was it 85? Yeah, 85.
Yeah.
85.
Yeah,
so, like,
great.
You know, he still had a lot to offer when you realize then he was only 64 when Hee Haw went off the air. And
he is,
like I said, one of those guys, one of those television presences like Johnny Carson that you really wish you had today, because I feel like they really would have a social impact in healing some divides. But
some divides. It's the crossover guys.
Okay, Catherine McGregor, 93. Not a household name, but if you were a Little House on the Prairie fan, and I know you were, Dean Haglund, having grown up in a Little House on the Prairie.
Well, you know, maybe that one was too close to home.
If only because your dad's hairdo was so evocative of Michael Landon.
It's true. Nothing like a fantastic curly mullet.
Your dad, very masculine, and so masculine that he had no problem sporting a girlish bouffant. Anyway, she played, Catherine McGregor played Harriet, and her daughter Nellie were the nemesis of the Ingalls family, the nemesis
family.
And played it for the full run of the show from 74 until 83. And
good Lord,
even though fans hated the character, she was very, very popular because indeed, right, we talk about this with villains. There are villains you hate. There are villains you love to hate. And there are villains you hate to love. And honestly, if you have either of the last two, you're really going to be a fixture in people's memory, right?
That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and that show needed something like her anyway, because otherwise it would just be a bit saccharine, a little too sweet. So
she was an accomplished stage actor before moving into guest spots on television shows and appeared on all the big shows of the time, Mannix, Emergency, All in the Family. So like all your great stage actors, was equally adept in sitcom or dramatic acting, right? After Little House on the Prairie, how about this? This is odd. This is not odd. This is unique. Her post Little House on the Prairie career, she taught acting to children. Okay, I'm on board with that. At the Wee Hollywood Vedanta Players, dedicating herself to the Hindu religion.
Wait.
Yeah.
Because there's does this still exist? Is this
well, there is the Vedanta Center that most people don't know about over on Hollywood. It's hidden through one of those secret underpasses just north of Franklin. There's the Vedanta Center. And it's like a Taj Mahal, a mini Taj Mahal in the heart of Hollywood that most people don't know about. And
so they had a theater in there? Or
one there Halloween, was a theater company I hate to admit this, but one Halloween night, I went trick-or-treating at the Vedanta Center not too long ago. Not this year.
Not too long ago.
And trick-or-treating is a euphemism for availing myself of their bathroom. And availing myself of their bathroom is a euphemism for being so drunk that I did something unspeakable on the front steps of their building.
Oh, my God.
Not proud.
You know, you could have not shared that story. I guess.
Yeah. But it's therapeutic. This show is therapeutic for all, for listeners and for you, truly. Let's move on, shall we? And
shall
discuss
we?
Pablo Ferro. This man was 83 when he died. And it's amazing, again, to see that he was kind of so young, given some of the things he's most famous for. He was known most famously for his distinct title design work in graphic design. He died of pneumonia in Sedona, Arizona, won many awards. He was born in 1935 in Cuba. And Ferro was a self-taught artist who became known for eye-catching and stylized title design in movies, including such iconic title designs as Stanley Kubrick's Dr. Strangelove, as well as Stanley Kubrick's A Clockwork Orange.
Ah, see, that was fantastic. Yes, with the triangle.
As well as Bullet. Men in Black. How good is it to realize that Men in Black kind of stencil design, which was so evocative of Dr. Strangelove, was in fact done by the same guy that did Dr. Strangelove. I always love, you know, I mean, I liked that it felt like Strangelove, but to know that it was the same guy hired to do it makes me a lot happier, right?
Yes.
And did Married to the Mob, so a wide variety of genres that he lent himself to across the decades. But during the 50s, he worked in animation before working with a Disney animator, Titla, who would become his mentor. And he worked with a would-be legend named Stan Lee on a series of sci-fi and adventure comics.
Cool.
became a Farrell became a trailblazer when it came to montage-like title sequences, creative stylistic typefaces, quick-cut editing. His art can be seen in over 100 movies. I've mentioned many of them. A few of the others: Thomas Crown Affair, the original, Philadelphia, To Live and Die in L.A., Beetlejuice, Jesus Christ Superstar, The Addams Family,
wow,
Zardoz, Harold and Maude, as well as Gus Van Sant's To Die For and Good Will Hunting. So Farrow dies in a week where several of these things are coming up in other celebrity deaths. We need to move on, but I would be remiss if I did not mention that he also did the first animated color version of the NBC Peacock.
Oh, you're kidding. Yeah. See, now that's, you never think that that's, there was a first one. Yeah, I guess there had to be.
He also worked on Midnight Cowboy as the second unit director. This is a talented guy.
I'll say.
And a versatile guy, because that's a different skill set. He was the supervising editor of The Night They Raided Minsky's, and in 1991 directed his own feature, Me, Myself, and I, starring George Segal and Joe Beth Williams. His work in title design has appeared in 12 Academy Award-winning films. He won numerous Clios for advertising and a Directors Guild of America Excellence in Film Award.
Ah, Pablo Farrell.
Okay, Dean, if I were to say to you that a man died, he was 90 years old, who gave one of the greatest all-time character performances in film, one of the truly handful of greatest character performances in film without that character ever appearing on screen, what would you think of?
Carl Malden. Who would I think
of? Who did Carl Malden play that didn't appear on screen? I don't understand.
Wait, the greatest character performance.
And that character does not appear on screen.
Are we talking about the voice of this person?
Yes. Yeah,
we're talking the voice of HAL from 2001.
We
Space
are
Odyssey.
Indeed. Douglas Rain, the voice of HAL 9000, heard at the outset of today's installment of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour, died in Stratford, Ontario. He was 90 years old, died of natural causes. For many people, it was the death of one of the truly great Shakespearean actors of all time. He was born in 1928 in Winnipeg.
In Winnipeg, another Winnipeg boy.
Began his career as a radio actor and then trained at the Old Vic Theatre in London. So already had obviously learned how to use his voice and then got that Shakespearean training. And he was a truly trailblazing member of the Stratford Festival. The Repertory Theater Festival based there in Stratford, Ontario.
Yes, that still goes strong every year. It's a big deal.
In the 1953 inaugural season, he played Marquis of Dorset and Tyrell in William Shakespeare's Richard III, I'm sorry.
Richard III.
And was the understudy for the title role of that play, which was portrayed by none other than Sir Alec Guinness.
Wow.
Rain continued to perform in numerous Shakespearean plays at the Stratford Festival for 32 seasons, making his final appearance in the festival production of A Man for All Seasons in 98.
Wow. That's a good run.
In 1972, he received a Tony nomination for his role in Robert Bolt's Vivat, Vivat, Regina, which he appeared in opposite Claire Bloom.
Oh, neat.
Yeah, isn't that amazing?
How cool is that?
And TV versions of Shakespeare. But again, just think of how chilling and heartbreaking his performance is in as HAL 9000 in 2001 A Space Odyssey. What a great actor.
Yeah,
that man was.
Did he would he have been in 2010 too?
The
sequel.
Yeah, they track him down, and he's HAL. Absolutely, he really lends the film some soul.
Yeah. How cool. Wow.
All right. I think we will save our memory of Stan Lee for next week because it opens up a lot of issues. And everybody knows that Stan Lee died, and there have been so many memories of Stan Lee. So we'll move on to one more, but I will leave this about Stan Lee, you know, because for many people it was very sad that he died. But here's here's the positive spin on it was given to us by one newspaper that mistakenly wrote in their headline next to Stan Lee's picture that filmmaker Spike Lee dead at 95.
Wow. That's rapid aging.
And why that made me happy was that with all the divisiveness and all the racial dog whistles that get used these days for manipulation of the voting populace, it was nice to see proof that we are actually living in a post-racial America. Because how else can you take the fact that Spike Lee could be mistaken for a 95-year-old white man other than the fact that America has finally become colorblind?
And there you go.
And that we are no longer ageist. I think that's terrific. that at 95, a 95-year-old white man could direct Black Klansmen, I think is... It gives us hope for our society.
What paper did that?
So we will remember Stan Lee on next week's show, but we'll give the final word to that great chronicler of adventures in the screen trade, which was the name of his memoir, William Goldman.
Oh, yes.
The Academy Award-winning screenwriter of such classics as Butch Cassidy and The Sundance Kid, and as you know, one of my all-time favorites, All the President's Men.
Yeah.
He died of colon cancer at 87 years of age. His enduring creations also include The Princess Bride, both the 1973 novel and the script that he adapted for the 1987 cult classic film.
Right.
And he wrote other novels as well, including the really harrowing Magic, about the ventriloquist puppet that comes to life.
Oh, yeah.
He did write that classic tale of adventure. And boy, the book tonally is different than the Rob Reiner movie, The Princess Bride.
Right.
But it was the story of True Love Born. Was a story for his young daughters. One had requested a story about a princess, and the other wanted to hear about a bride. So he combined the two, making up silly names like Buttercup and Humperdinck to amuse his girls. And the story stuck with him until he decided to write it into a novel many years later. But he struggled with it until he made one unusual decision. He would write it as an abridged version of an imaginary longer novel by a made-up author, S. Morgenstern.
And he
went on to extend the joke further by writing a second novel under the name S. Morgenstern, 1983's The Silent Gondoliers. His notable quote that's always ascribed to him is, "Nobody knows anything." Not one person in the entire motion picture field knows for a certainty what's going to work. Every time out, it's a guess, and if you're lucky, an educated one.
Right.
I like that if you're lucky, it's educated, because it means you've been lucky enough to derive an education in what you're doing. You know, that's really good, because it means you are lucky enough to have worked long enough to have developed that education. It also should be said that we lose probably what is a dying breed, which is the script doctor.
Yes, that was his key thing, right? He would often teach.
We see so often many teams of screenwriters credited, because we know that every producer, all they do sometimes to justify their fee and their title is to assign their own set of go-to screenwriters to come on and polish and rework a script. William Goldman was one of those rarities, those giant screenwriters who had no problem taking no credit as long as you paid him his $1 million. And he would and he would ghost adapt or ghost write or ghost fix a script. Perhaps most famously, of course, the script he wrote for Good Will Hunting.
Yes.
A script for, then, for which Affleck and Damon win the Oscar. But it was,
and then he writes that thing in the L.A. Times, doesn't he?
Well, he
is that the one?
He says that he did not write it. He says that they wrote it. But again, as we've talked about before, Weinstein was brilliant at marketing. And let's say you have the same script written by veteran screenwriter William Goldman that's worthy of an Oscar. But is that nearly as marketable as, hey, these two handsome 20-something-year-old actors wrote their own script?
Right?
No, it isn't.
And then went on to never write again.
Never wrote another script again, yeah. No, so it was Goldman who pointed out that it was a mistake in this script to have it focus on a CIA storyline using the math genius as a code breaker. That storyline exists for all of one scene now in the finished version, and that was the main thrust of the Affleck-Damon screenplay. You know, basically, think about the scene where Ben Affleck goes pretending to be Matt Damon for the job interview with the CIA, and that's where was the jumping-off point for the Affleck-Damon script. So you can get some sense of how much Goldman was responsible for reworking the film. All right.
Okay.
That brings us to the end of another action-packed installment of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. If you are going to be in Los Angeles this Thanksgiving Day weekend, or can make it here to all people within the sound of my voice, I'm turning 50 on Sunday, and I want to see you at Friendship Auditorium as I host a show, a variety show called Goodbye 40s, Hello 50s. You can learn more at EncoreSundays.eventbrite.com.
Look at that. That'll be your birthday.
Until next week, I am a 49-year-old Phil Larinus inviting you to check out every installment of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour at ChillPackHollywood.com.
Yay! I'm Dean Haglin. We'll see you then.
Guests of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour stay at the Baldwin Hills Motor Inn. Promotional consideration paid for by Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas. Belated spoiler alert.